This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Big changes afoot in the mental health community. The Bible of the psychiatric community is something called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM for short. It's gone through four revisions since it was first published in 1952, and now the fifth revision is here, and it's creating anxiety for a lot of parties involved, doctors, patients, their families, and insurance companies. Dan Blazer is here, and he can tell us about the changes and the controversies. He's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University. He's also a professor of community and family medicine there, and he was a member of the neurocognitive work group for the DSM-5 and part of the scientific review committee. Dan Blazer, welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
Well, maybe you should give us some background first. The DSM, why is it so important? What is it?
So psychiatry has long needed a way to classify the conditions that we tend to see in our offices. This is not only for billing purposes, but it is certainly there for billing purposes, but also there for helping us to communicate with one another in a more convenient and efficient way. But in addition, I think it's a way that we can categorize individuals such that we may be able to understand better the causes of psychiatric disorders, and we can design treatments which will maybe affect one type of individual compared to another.
You know, it gives everybody a way to talk about the same thing roughly, and then you can, as you say, communicate better. And, of course, psychiatry is a subjective, much more subjective kind of analysis than other forms of medicine. Can't really do a blood test as easily.
It is. I mean, we hope the day will come when we'll be able to do more objective testing, brain scans, blood tests, various types of ways in which to try to better understand mental illness. But at the present time, we are mostly limited to what we hear from our patients and how we categorize what we hear and what we see.
So what prompted the development of the first DSM? Was it these questions and concerns, right?
There was a international classification of diseases that had been around for a very long period of time. The sense was that that did not serve psychiatry particularly well. And so in 1952, members of the American Psychiatric Association decided that it was time to try to develop a classification that would be congruent with the international classification, but at the same time would take advantage of what was thought to be known at that time regarding psychiatric disorders.
There have been four revisions up to now. This is the fifth. Tell us about the revision process. What goes on?
Well, the revision process, the process itself relates to a group of clinicians and scientists and advisors who sit down, talk about the state of the field, see if our current classifications, in fact, still serve the field well, and if they don't, make choices about which ones should be changed, which ones should not, and in what ways they should be changed. The revisions have gone through, as you mentioned, four so far, and we're in the midst of going through a fifth revision. The sea change occurred in 1980 with the third edition of the DSM. Prior to that, the classifications were based on text descriptions, so you would have maybe a paragraph describing what schizophrenia was, what depression was, et cetera. In DSM-3 in 1980, it was decided that for a number of reasons, we needed to be more specific about what made up a psychiatric disorder. To put it another way, we need to be more specific about who would be included and who would be excluded from receiving a psychiatric disorder. And therefore, we came up with a series of clear criteria. So, for example, if you suffered from major depression, then you had to have a depressed mood, or you needed to also have just a feeling of not caring about anything. Plus, you needed to have 5 of 8 additional symptoms. These symptoms might include sleep problems, appetite problems, et cetera. And so you can make a very clear distinction between who would have a disorder and who would not have a disorder.
Of course, this is very important not only for communication, as you say, among psychiatrists and education, but now for insurance purposes, who's going to be covered and who's not.
Absolutely. And so the reliability, and that is the ability of one clinician to agree with another clinician, and the ability to agree on a diagnosis over time, unless the condition itself actually changed, improved significantly with DSM-3. that brought a lot of consternation to the field. So DSM-5 is not the first time that we've had controversy in the field, because many people felt that we were sacrificing a lot of depth and richness and knowledge of individuals and how people respond to the stresses that they experience in their lives on what they termed at one time the altar of reliability. In other words, we're moving more towards something very strict and scientific as opposed to really taking into account the nuances that we actually see with individuals who suffer from mental disorders.
And yet these are still subjective qualitative evaluations and also based on the reliability, the reporting of the patient themselves. Are you having a sleep problem? Are you having trouble getting to sleep? How do you feel? You know?
Right. We depend on what our patients tell us or we depend on what we can see. Medicine itself was that way 50, 75 years ago, and so we're maybe a little behind much of other medicine because we do not have the diagnostic test. But still, if you even look at biological tests for many disorders, you don't know exactly what's happening. So medicine itself is subjective. As much as we would like to think it was totally objective, it's not.
Somebody's got to read those test results, even if they do are measured in pretty scientific terms. So what prompts the change? Who decides it's time to change and by what authority? And, you know, what's the impetus?
Well, DSM process is sponsored by the American Psychiatric Association. So periodically, they will gather clinicians and educators and scientists together and say, are we ready to go through the process of a change? And that will be sort of the starting point. The change is a major process. It's expensive. It's time-consuming. It changes a paradigm that clinicians and scientists themselves are accustomed to. And so any change is not something that's taken lightly. But it's been really since 1994 that we've had our last revision, and so I think people felt especially that the advances we had made in neuroscience, understanding the brain, advances we've made in understanding specific treatments, advances we've made in understanding exactly where the boundaries are between one particular condition versus another, we've gained a considerable amount of knowledge, and that in turn has led to the decision back in 2007, 2008, that we needed to go through another revision.
So this process has been going on for 4 years.
At least, yes.
Yeah. So what are the changes? What will we see in this new revised edition?
Well, the changes are not as dramatic as some people would say they are, but there's some significant changes. This format is still the same. In other words, you have very specific criteria for specific disorders. But some of the boundaries of the disorders, in fact, have changed. Perhaps I can give you two examples that would explain this. The first would be the elimination of specific types of autism or Asperger's syndrome and putting these together in a condition that's called autism spectrum disorder. The rationale here is a scientific rationale. It's based on the fact that we really can't make a clear distinction between, for example, autism and Asperger's syndrome. It falls along a continuum. And so therefore, it makes more sense to have these combined into one diagnosis, but then having that diagnosis actually expand a little bit in terms of its boundary from the traditional autism. The fear in this particular situation was that many individuals who previously would have been covered under insurance or covered under federal or state programs for Asperger's syndrome would get lost in the process because the criteria would be more restrictive. Well, I've looked at the data on this, and that does not appear to be a major fear. I think that the new autism spectrum disorder diagnosis, in fact, is going to cover virtually the same individuals that were covered previously by the different disorders that went into that autism conglomerate. However, there's much concern about this.
Well, let me ask you, because at one point I thought I heard you say that the parameters would be broader, and I got the feeling that more people might be included within the spectrum, though Asperger's itself as a category would be eliminated. Now, did I get that right?
Well, the point is that we have a more uniform diagnosis now. And so perhaps the number of people that actually are captured is basically the same. But the number of individuals who would be diagnosed with autism compared to autism spectrum disorder, we will see more diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder because it's going to include those individuals who would also have previously been diagnosed with Asperger's
syndrome. And is there any difference in the coverage? If I had Asperger's and I'm now going to be considered autistic in this spectrum, am I still covered?
Obviously, that's depending on the third-party payers. I think our feeling is, and I think most people would agree, that actually there should be no difference between individuals who receive the diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder versus those who receive a diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome in terms of their coverage. The fear has been that with this new approach to the diagnosis, in other words, looking at it as a continuum, looking at it as a one diagnosis as opposed to two or three, then in fact some people who were previously diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome will no longer be diagnosed. So that was the fear.
Now, in some other areas, I understand there's a concern about children, say, who have temper tantrums will now possibly be labeled as having a mental disorder.
Yes, and that is another area. This, I have to confess, this is not my area. I actually am a geriatric psychiatrist, so I deal with the opposite end of the life cycle. But that is a fear that a new diagnosis, I think that diagnosis is called disruptive mood dysregulation, that actually individuals are going to be captured. Perhaps I can give an example of one that I am more familiar with, though, where there is concern about we casting the net too widely. And that is we now are going to be adding a diagnosis of mild neurocognitive impairment. Now, that's a mouthful. But to make a long story short, we used to have a diagnosis of dementia. And virtually nobody disagreed that dementia was a disorder. It needed to be classified. We needed to be looking for treatments for it. It was not normal. There were a number of different types of dementia, Alzheimer's disease, vascular dementia, dementias associated with Parkinson's disease, et cetera. So recent studies have suggested that we're increasingly becoming skilled in picking up individuals who are suffering from a neurocognitive disorder earlier in their course of illness than we've been able to do previously. And so to put it in a sort of a metaphor, we're pushing the ability to identify people upstream. Mm-hmm. And so by pushing them upstream, we felt that we needed an additional category which we have called mild neurocognitive impairment, and we are contrasting that with what we call major neurocognitive impairment, which is the equivalent of what used to be dementia. And so now in the new classification in DSM-5, everyone will be categorized initially as either having mild or major neurocognitive impairment, and then an attribution of a specific etiology will be brought in, such as Alzheimer's disease. This has created a lot of concern because it will lead to more people being included in the classification that had been included previously, and there have been great fears that pharmaceutical companies will take advantage of this and be trying to sell medications. The fact of the matter is we have no treatment at the present time for which we know that mild or even major neurocognitive disorders due to Alzheimer's disease, in fact, can be treated effectively. Obviously, we're looking very desperately to try to find those things, but we feel that providing a classification for those individuals with mild cognitive impairment actually recognizes something that clinicians see all the time, and that is people are coming to their offices. They're saying, you know, I'm worried about my memory. I'm having more difficulty driving. I'm having more difficulty keeping my track. But I can do all those things, but I'm just taking more time to do them. And we can actually pick up problems with their functioning that are below the normal range. And so we've sort of pushed upstream, and we will cast our net wider by pushing the diagnosis upstream. But nevertheless, we feel like this is really in service of our patients. That's an area that's been widely criticized because people have said, well, you're just going to let everybody who has a little concern about their memory into the classification. That's actually not the case, but I think it represents the kind of fear some people have that this is going to be too inclusive.
Let's take another example of that kind of thing and then talk about it more generally. The so-called bereavement exclusion changes now. You can maybe describe for us what that is and the implications of that.
That has been one of the more hotly contested areas. So in the past, if an individual had all the symptoms of what we call major depressive disorder, and at the same time, they had experienced a significant loss, let's say the death of a spouse had occurred within the last 2 or 3 months, then they would be excluded from the diagnosis of major depression because they had had the experience of losing the spouse 3 months prior. That exclusion has been excluded.
Right. So you can't get medicated, you can't get diagnosed,
right.
you can't get over it.
So now In the current classification, individuals who have clear major depression, based on the criteria that we have for major depression, will now be able to receive that diagnosis. And the evidence suggests, and I've actually looked at this evidence, I've not been participated in the research itself, it's pretty clear that these individuals can benefit from psychotherapy, they can benefit from medication, that will improve their course. And so this, again, has led to a great concern among some that, well, does that mean that everybody who is sad or down after they lose somebody is now going to be prey to a psychiatric diagnosis and treatment? No, that's not the case. But if individuals have this diagnosis of a major depressive episode, then the evidence suggests that they should be treated.
And the fear is, of course, not that people have a treatment and a way out of these very difficult circumstances, but that perhaps we're medicalizing what we used to think of as the human condition, and there's a danger there that the pharmaceutical companies are going to sort of step in where we were helping ourselves before.
And Frank, I think actually that's a very real concern. And I think anyone who is honest and will pull themselves out of their silo, if they happen to be in a scientific silo, should recognize that we always have to realize individuals with psychiatric disorders experience human suffering. And that human suffering is not just a psychiatric diagnosis. Human suffering can come from very real causes. It can be a very real human and very natural experience. In our work in DSM-5, I think we worked very hard in order to try to not exclude individuals who we felt could benefit from psychiatric care, but at the same time recognize that not everyone who suffers has a psychiatric diagnosis.
Dan, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for helping us out with this.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Dan Blaser, a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University, a professor of community and family medicine, and a member of the neurocognitive work group on the DSM-5 and part of the scientific review committee as well. That's our program for today. Thank you for listening. You can find us on the web at stateofthings.org. Our program is directed by Alex Granados, produced by Sean Wen, Nicole Campbell, and Dave DeWitt. Robin Copley is the technical director, Brent Wolf, our news director, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.